You see it every day. The first dollar you earned from your first customer. Now it hangs on your wall at headquarters. A reminder of where you started and the promise of what's still to come. In part because you rely on Sandy Spring Bank to help you make the right choices on real estate and equipment loans, treasury management, and commercial services. We believe real banking is a conversation. Let's talk about your business. Visit sandyspringbank.com/business. Credit products offered by Sandy Spring Bank.
Listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with WISP Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. For those who don't know the Tucker Center, it's the first of its kind, world-class research center and thought leader that accelerates systems change for girls and women in sport. Tucker Center Talks is a place where I get to talk to, amplify, and support my female colleagues. We let the data tell the story, and we talk about research and ways in which we use data to disrupt and change the world through the context of sport to be a better place. There is no better person to talk to than letting the data tell the story than Dr. Mary Jo Kane, who is a professor emerita in the School of Kinesiology at the University of Minnesota, but more importantly, the founder and first director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. Welcome back to Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Kane.
Thank you for inviting me, Dr. Lavoie, and I couldn't be more delighted to be here. And let me just say, I love the idea of thinking about the Tucker Center as a thought leader. That's really good and very true.
I couldn't agree more. And speaking of thought leaders, you are considered by myself and many around the world as a thought leader for girls and women in sport. So since you are now retired, congratulations to you for that. What a time to retire right before COVID hits. You couldn't have timed that any better.
Yes, I have told a number of people that if you believe in guardian angels, and I do, that I happen to have one, she said to me, this is the time to retire, Dr. Kane. And although I have deep compassion and love and sympathy for you and all my colleagues in the academy, as well as the students, I have to say it's a guilty pleasure to be no longer in the academy in any formal way.
Well, now that you are retired and you get to consume sport at your leisure, I'm really interested in talking to you right now about, I mean, we're right now in the Summer Olympics, 2021 Tokyo Summer Olympics. There's a lot of talk about girls and women in sport, but what I'm curious for you to share with us is, what do you see as like the major cultural narratives around women in sport? What are the trends and key issues that you see right now?
That's a really important question. And there is no one single magic bullet answer. I think the first thing that I'm really aware of, and it may be heightened or highlighted because of the Olympics, where it's the one time where women athletes and women's sports do tend to get significantly more coverage than they do during the rest of the year or years, is frankly how seriously women's sports are taken. They are getting a lot of coverage. And the coverage really highlights their athleticism far more than, and as somebody who has followed media representations of female athletes in women's sports for literally 35 to 40 years, there has been a huge cultural shift in terms of how women are covered when they are covered, mm-hmm. meaning there is an emphasis on their athleticism. There is an emphasis on their mental toughness. There is an emphasis on highlighting stars like Megan Rapinoe or Simone Biles or Katie Ledecky. There is an emphasis in team sports on strategy, like in women's basketball, and coaching rivalries and team rivalries, meaning that women's sports are finally starting to be covered when they are covered in ways that very much mimic how males sports have always been covered. And that is an absolute sea change from when I first started doing my research and paying attention almost 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I
thought of you, Dr. Kane, because the IOC came out with a statement around media coverage of athletes at the Olympics that says sport appeal, not sex appeal. And I thought, wow, that sounds really familiar, because your famous soundbite is sex sells sex, sex doesn't sell women's sport. And I just wonder, like, if that has influenced people at the very top of the Olympic movement.
Well, I certainly hope so. And I know that, as is often the case, at least in the United States, that commercialism and moving product will often top just about anything. And certainly, I think Nike and other major corporate sponsors and corporate brands realized, especially in the wake of the 2019 Women's World Cup, that there was an enormous untapped market out there for women's sports in terms of attendance, in terms of viewership, both in terms of traditional television, live streaming, social media, and then, of course, moving their product. And that the way to do that was to treat female athletes as highly competent athletes rather than as sexy babes. Now, that said, you know, you do have what is increasingly, I think, kind of a one-off or an end of one, which was the whole issue, not in the Olympics, but of the Norwegian women's,
handball team.
Beach handball team,
yep.
Refusing to wear those uniforms. And the backlash that the Federation received for insisting that they do so and for fining them if they did not wear the traditional sexy babe uniforms. Mm-hmm. And I think that this pivots to a second trend in women's sports. And this is something that I really realized over the last few years. And that is, and I've talked about the impact of Title IX, especially obviously in the United States. And another way that I've talked about this, as you well know, is that because of Title IX, passed in 1972, we're now approaching the 50th anniversary of Title IX next year. Let me get in a plug for the University of Minnesota, where the University of Minnesota and the Twin Cities will be hosting the Women's Final Four, celebrating and honoring the 50th anniversary of Title IX. But one of the things that's happened, in addition to having really generations of girls now growing up with the sense of entitlement to sports, and that leads to another trend, which is that I think for the first time in our history, this generation feels self-righteous, as well they should, when they are slighted, and they do not go quietly into that dark night. And mm-hmm. So the Women's World Cup in 2019, where Rapinoe and Carly Lloyd and others made it a social cause around equal pay. And when they were criticized for not just focusing on playing sports, they didn't say, oh, we're so sorry, we apologize. They actually doubled down. It then became a social movement. At the Women's Final Four last April, mm-hmm. when both men's and women's teams were in a pod, and it became very clear that the women's facilities and food and swag were beyond second-class citizenship. The reaction wasn't, well, at least we're here. The reaction was, this is an outrage. We're going to film it and put it on social media. And there was an enormous backlash against the NCAA, not against the women, the uppity women. And again, that shows, I think, a social acceptance of it is not okay to treat these women as second-class citizens. That is an enormous shift from where we were in the pre-Title IX days.
Yeah, where women were supposed to just be grateful for having the opportunity to be on the court or on the field. Now they're like, we're here. And we want to be treated equally to our male counterparts. And I think that is definitely a cultural shift. Okay, so we've got serious media coverage, female athletes exercising their agency in ways that seems different than in past. Is there any other cultural sort of master narratives of women in sport right now that you think's worth touching upon?
Well, I think the other master narrative, which of course this is all interrelated, and I get calls still from the press, and I'm assuming you do as well, which is, what are we going to do about the pay gap and pushing towards pay equity and gender equity? And so that too then becomes kind of a foundational narrative for, we no longer have to argue or fight about whether or not women belong in the arena of the sports world, whether or not they are deserving of being there, and whether or not when they are there, they have an enormous, I was watching, I'm a golfer, as are you, Nicole.
Yep.
And so I've been, and I know I love to play golf, and I also know how hard it is. And I've been watching a little bit at night of the women's, you know, the gold medal and the medal rounds for women's golf.
I was too last night. It was so fun to see them.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know if each country has X many number of athletes on their team. I don't know the specifics, but so many countries are represented. And what kept striking me, and this is true for all of the sports, is, oh my God, these women are incredibly good.
Oh yeah.
One of the women from Denmark hit a drive 300 yards. It's like, are you kidding me?
I think she drove the green.
Yeah, and they're making every putt, and they're hitting their you know, I don't know, anywhere from their pitching wedge out to a 7-iron 10 feet from the hole.
I know, and they, you know, there was like eagles and birdies all over the place, and I was thinking, wow, this is really spectacular golf.
Totally. And spectacular athletic competence all across the, you know, the vast range of sports and athleticism. And I bring this up as a trend because, especially again in the United States, performance dictates everything. And so if women continue to shine as great athletes on an international and national stage, it moves beyond, this is a feel-good story and this is the right thing to do for our daughters. But, oh my God, these women are really, really great athletes. That starts a foundation from which to carry on the argument about pay equity and closing the pay gap. Now, again, I am not suggesting, for example, I mean, the largest pay gap, I think, is clearly to me in the WNBA versus the NBA. And what I have said is, I am not in any way suggesting that WNBA players should make the same amount of money as, for example, LeBron James. I'm not saying that. But the gap is so extraordinary. And there's always this comparison. And this makes sense logically. When you're talking about a pay gap, then you automatically compare women's performance to men's performance in the same sport. And I get that. But what we forget is the background of, we have always emphasized and rewarded and praised men's athleticism. And in fact, if you were a male and didn't play sports, you were stigmatized. And the opposite has been true for women. Especially in highly competitive team sports, again, until Title IX 50 years ago. And so what I always try to keep to the forefront in these discussions is that to compare men's and women's sports is a false comparison. It's like comparing apples and oranges, whereas what you really, it's, the example that I use is a tech company. And it's like comparing a startup tech company to Apple. It's not a fair comparison. Women's sports just got started. The question is, with each new generation, what is the trend line and how much better are these women getting? And they are getting exponentially better with each new generation. And I think that, again, helps make the argument that women deserve equity, not necessarily equal pay, but certainly equity around performance.
Well, and I think this equal pay conversation, when you're looking at a national team or an Olympic team, where it's really the same job, you know, you're playing on the U.S. women's soccer team or the men's U.S. soccer team. The women make the Olympics. The men, I don't even know if they've ever been in the Olympics for soccer, but the women are clearly superior. But it's the same job. You're on the national team representing the U.S. The pay and resources should be equal, in my opinion. Now, the WNBA, NBA, that I, you know, that's more complicated. But when you're on the national team, it's the same job. End of story, in my opinion.
Yes. And if you want to use all the standard markers that is always used as the narrative to say women don't deserve to get the same amount of pay because they don't get the same amount of corporate sponsorship. They don't have the same attendance levels. They don't have the same media coverage.
People aren't as interested, which we know isn't true.
Right. And so if let's take men's and women's soccer. If you use those standard traditional markers of comparison, the women's soccer team, the U.S. women's soccer team, blows the men's soccer team out of the water.
And right.
So they absolutely should not only have equal pay, they should have more pay.
Yes.
But yet whenever you start having whenever you start having those conversations, the goalpost is simply shifted.
Right.
But that said, one of the great things about sports, and I was thinking about this the other day, years and years and years ago, Nancy Theberge and Susan Burrell, who are two pioneers in women's sports sociology, talked about, and I have written about this as well, is that sport has always been a site of reinforcing stereotypes and reinforcing male privilege. Mm-hmm. For all the obvious reasons. But what sport also could be, and this was their sort of vision for the future, that sport could also be, because of sport, of what sport represents, and because of the values that you're taught in sports and the lessons that you learn and the experiences that you have, is that sport could also become an enormous site or fertile ground for women's resistance. And that is exactly what has happened 30, 40 years on, which is to say these young women learn all the lessons in sports, which is we're tough, we deserve to be here, we're not going to take a back seat. And if you tell us that we can't win, well, guess what? We'll see you tomorrow. We'll be back the day after, the day after, the day after, because sport teaches you resilience, it teaches you how to lose, and it teaches you always, there is always another day, another time, another opportunity. And that is why these young women absolutely refuse to back down from being treated with respect and dignity and equality. Mm. And I am incredibly proud of them for that.
You and others have argued this is precisely if sport is a site where women, you know, grow confident and strong and resilient and become advocates for themselves. This is precisely why we want to contain a mechanism of containment, to use your language, why we want to limit and prevent women from being in sport, because this is precisely what people in power, meaning mostly men, because men is, you know, sport is a man's domain, although that's changing. This is why we want to keep women out of sport.
Yes, that's exactly right. And again, you know, you don't drop an atom bomb on something that you don't care about. And so I think that in many ways, for a very, very long time, men have understood the stakes in the game far better than we have, even if it's on a really visceral, instinctual level. That, and this isn't just about men, this is about power. So that when any group has monopolized power, and especially in an institution like sports, I mean, there are very few institutions in this culture, I actually would argue there are no institutions in this culture that equal sport in terms of its ubiquity, its impact, both culturally and economically and socially and psychologically. There is enormous cultural investment, literally and figuratively, in this particular institution. Mm-hmm. And men have for centuries dominated it. And when any group in power dominates an institution, especially that is so powerful and so economically fertile, and especially when one's identity as a male is so closely tied to that institution, they are not going to just say, oh my God, I cannot believe that we haven't been giving 50% of everything to women. What an oversight. Right. I mean, that
here,
that
let me share.
Happen.
Let me
here,
share.
Let me give you, here, let me give you 50%. Right. And again, this isn't about beating up on men.
No.
This is about any group that has been the dominant group that has monopolized power. It is very hard for them to give that power up, whether or not it's people, white people, whether or not it's able-bodied people, whether or not it's social class. So I get mm-hmm. it. And so it's always going to be a power struggle. And nowhere do you learn about power struggles better than in the institution of sports.
So speaking of power struggles, and since we're talking about gender equity, and you brought up the women's Final Four, yesterday the NCAA and the Kaplan Heckler Law Firm released a gender equity review that they did on the tournaments. And one of the recommendations that everyone's latched onto is to hold the men's and women's tournament at the same site at the same time. So I have some thoughts on this, but I'd be curious what your like pro con reaction to that is. Is this a good idea or is it not a good idea? And why?
Yeah. I actually, Dr. Lavoie, would be interested to hear your take on it too. I'm still kind of digesting it because mm-hmm. yes, there is a part of me that says if women and men are at the same site, let's say for example, next April in Minneapolis, you would still, I would hope, have the same setup where you would have the women play on Friday and Sunday and the men play on Saturday and Monday. But if the women are in the same place as men, theoretically, they would be receiving the same amount or very similar amounts of media coverage, corporate sponsorship, access to outstanding facilities. So theoretically, that's how it would work. And it would, I think, again, pressure the NCAA to be even more, well, I should say forced to mm-hmm. Recognize and share power and resources. But, you know, because they don't get any money from football, the NCAA is completely, well, not completely, but almost entirely reliant on their television contracts around the men's Final Four.
Right.
So I get that. On the other hand, I like the idea of having women and men in different sites, meaning different cities, and being a power generator, an economic generator. So next year, when in April, when the Women's Final Four is here, theoretically, I think actually also in reality, it will be a big economic boost to the Twin Cities. And I don't know where the men's Final Four is, but wherever that is, a big economic boost to whatever city that is as well. Mm-hmm.
But it would be double the boost if you had the men, right? Or maybe not.
Well, I mean, that in theory is true. That said, would women get swallowed up?
Right.
I mean, there is something to be said, but separate and approaching equal I'm just saying, you know,
In theory, right.
Yeah. And I would worry that rather than highlight women even more, they would get swallowed up by the male tidal wave. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we could, you know, here's an idea. Maybe they could try it for 2 or 3 years and see how it works and then shift back if it doesn't. But that's really hard to do because, yeah. You know, you have bids, cities have bids and it takes forever to set it up. And,
right.
But that said, I don't know if Emirates had an official response to the report.
Not that I've seen yet.
Yeah. And I don't think the floodgates have opened on that. And frankly, I haven't seen, like, where is the Women's Basketball Coaches Association? Have they had a formal comment about this as well? I don't know, but there hasn't been this, well, it's about time. Let's have it in the same spot. Which should tell you everything exactly. So what do you think?
There was a lot of really good recommendations in there. Mostly, I thought the good ones were around structural inequalities of resources at the NCAA level that need to be fixed.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sort of digesting it too. I think there are probably some upsides, but to me, it sort of feels like when the AIAW got taken over by the NCAA, and right. some people were like, this is great. We're going to have the same everything that the men have, because now we're part of the NCAA. And then there were some people that said, oh, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. This is not going to be good for women's sport. And what we see down the line is it is and it isn't. So, I mean, it won't happen for a while because there's already host cities and bids out there. So we're probably, I don't know, 3 to 5 years out if they're wanting to combine it, but we'll see.
Yeah,
I just was wondering what you thought.
Yeah, again, I'm digesting it. And, you know, that actually leads me to another very significant trend in women's sports. And it's not just in women's sports, but speaking of the NCAA and the Supreme Court, name, image, and likeness.
Right.
And women, you know, so then the question becomes, are women going to get screwed on this? And I say, I don't think so, because you have a star women's basketball player like Paige Buchers, hello, is going to apparently sign up for millions of dollars. Katie Ledecky, I saw a list of all of her sponsorships, and I've already seen a couple of commercials with her in it. So star female athletes will be able to cash in, literally and figuratively, in ways that they never would have before. And Katie Ledecky, I mean, she's not at Stanford anymore, but Paige Buchers is at Connecticut, and she's going to make more money than a lot of male athletes who are unknowns, including on the right. football team. And so there's that. Then the question is, as Nick Saban said, this is going to create enormous resentment and jealousies in the locker rooms. I don't know. I don't think that's true. I think that
there's already jealousies in the locker room.
Exactly. And I think that the third string offensive lineman would be absolutely thrilled that their star quarterback, who's a Heisman Trophy candidate, can go out on the open market and try to cash in.
But the third string lineman too, though, theoretically could cash in too. And before NIL, nobody knows who the third string lineman is, but maybe he's charismatic or he has a certain skill that gives him visibility. So, you know, it's actually good for him too.
It could be. And in fact, don't quote me on the details here, but I saw where on one of the Division I football teams, the entire offensive line was going to have like, you know, at a local bar, they're like the deli sandwich named after them or something like that. I mean, I don't have the details, but I know I'm directionally correct. I think what's extraordinary about this, speaking of the NCAA, is that they once again have seemingly been caught completely flat-footed and unprepared for this decision. And I could have said to them a couple of years ago, you might want to try to come up with some sort of broad framework about what might happen if the Supreme Court ruled against you, because a lot of people think they will. And now it's just the wild, 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 wild west. And nobody has any idea where it's going. But that is absolutely a trend that will impact women's sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, frankly, in a good way, because it's opened up marketing opportunities for them where they can, again, go out on the open market and do your best, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's so much happening in women's sport right now. I really appreciate your insights and your big picture thinking on this, as always. If you had to, as we wrap up here, Dr. Kane, what research do we need to do? If you had to pick one, maybe two studies, or like, we really still need to do X, or if I were to come out of retirement, this would entice me to do so, what would it be?
Man, I don't know. I mean, that's a really
nothing's going to entice you out of retirement.
Well, nothing's going to entice me out of retirement. I mean, this is fine, but I don't have to worry about, you know, meeting a manuscript deadline and sitting down to a blank screen to write something up. You know, I don't know. I suppose maybe issues around trans athletes, which seems to be the next sort of power base and power struggle. But I have to say that, particularly in the field of sports sociology, I am very proud of that whole body of knowledge and the scholars who who work in that realm, and even in sports psychology too, around issues around, that was the whole issue. We didn't even talk about the issue of mental fatigue and pressure in the Olympics and Simone Biles and others. I don't know. I say that actually, I think it's a good thing that I don't know. Nothing springs to mind because it makes me feel like so many of the issues that need to be covered, are being analyzed. All the great work that you and the Tucker Center interns and your graduate student colleagues are doing with the longitudinal report about the decline of women in the coaching profession and giving universities grades for how many women they hire into coaching positions or athletic administration positions. I mean, I think that all of that work, the media work continues, issues around race and discrimination continue. So I think it's really a good thing that I don't know. There's nothing like, we need to, you know, flashing red lights, we need to go here. I think we've been there and we've always been ahead of the curve. And I think that the overlapping Venn diagram bodies of knowledge that sports scholars have created over the last 50 years has done us proud. Mm-hmm. And I think as we started this conversation, Nicole, the media work that has been done and the data that we have amassed has really shifted in terms of how female athletes are now covered. And I believe that the work that we've done in the academy has had an enormous impact on that, because as you always say, it's data-driven evidence that you can give to the gatekeepers and the producers of those images. And I think we've had an enormous impact on media coverage, and I'm very proud of that.
As you should be. And, you know, I, going back to that earlier comment, is when the IOC says, you know, sport appeal, not sex appeal, they, you know, they didn't come up with that on their own. They're looking at the data and how they want to market and promote the Olympics. So it absolutely has had an impact. Okay, we're going to finish with a off the cuff speed round. Are you ready?
Uh-oh. Yep. Sure. I don't know what that means, but okay. Sure.
Little short questions, no right or wrong answer. First thing that pops into your head, who is your favorite badass woman right now?
In sports?
In any, it, however you want to answer it.
Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, okay. Going political. All right. If you're reading a book or listening to a podcast, what is your favorite book you're reading right now?
You know, I'm actually not reading a book right now, and I'm wondering how much of that is COVID, and maybe also is because I just am having a hard time concentrating. I watch, and for the first time ever in my life, I am binge watching series. But by binge watching, for me, that means two episodes versus one. Sorry, I just can't do it. I just feel guilty. But I love BBC Masterpiece Mystery Theater. Okay. I love that. And I've also been watching a lot of the Women's Olympics, and that has been really great. Really, really great.
Yeah, I find it hard to really do anything productive when the Olympics is on because I just want to take it all in.
Right.
All right. So speaking of the Olympics, I'm stealing this question from the women on the Burn It All Down podcast. They asked this question on their podcast yesterday. I was listening to it. If you could put, okay, so the triathlon is swimming, biking, and running. If you got to put together your own Olympic triathlon, your own Olympic triathlon with any three sports, what would they be?
For me personally,
yeah,
or
this
athletes?
Is your Mary Jo Kane's personal Olympic triathlon, and you could be any three sports. What would you pick?
Golf. No.
Okay, golf, and you get two more.
Okay, so actually, this summer and in some of COVID too, I have picked up riding a bicycle, and my. And I've gone 21 miles is my longest so far. And for a rookie, that's not bad.
That's great.
In fact, I told the person that I ride with regularly that I want to, over the weekend, go push myself to 25 miles, which if you're not a bike rider is no small thing.
Nope, that's awesome.
And then I would say hiking on something, maybe a difficult terrain, because I love to hike.
Okay, but that's not an Olympic sport.
So hiking is, it has to be an Olympic sport.
It has to be
an
Olympic sport. So we've got golf and cycling, road cycling.
Oh my Lord. I'm just not any good at anything else. What else is there? I mean, there's a million sports.
Well, yeah. What would be one that you'd like to try if you trained?
You know what? I am a pretty good volleyball player.
Okay.
I just don't want to do beach volleyball.
So
volleyball.
You're going to be the new libero, right?
There you go.
Okay. So we've got cycling, golf, and volleyball, Dr. Kane's trifecta. Okay. So mine would be archery. I'm obsessed with archery. I think it's so cool. Pole vaulting.
Wow.
I mean, I've never done it and I never will, but I think it's amazing. And I would pick golf as well.
Yeah. Well, I like archery and pole vaulting. That's great.
Yeah. So I thought that was sort of a fun little intellectual activity. What would you pick? And I think if I went winter, I'd have to put curling, right?
Oh, yeah.
And snowboard, snowcross, and maybe Nordic skiing. I think they're amazing.
Yeah, no, they are amazing. What were they saying on Burn It All Down?
Oh, it was all over the map.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, cool. Well,
there
thank
you.
Go. That was fun. A fun exercise.
Okay. Well, our time on Tucker Center Talks has come to an end. Thanks again for being on season 3. If you want to listen more for Dr. Kane, she also has episodes on season 1 and 2. Of Tucker Center Talks. So be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And you can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wisports.com. Look for Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for Tucker Center Talks. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, getting to talk with our Tucker Center founder and first director, Dr. Mary Jo Kane. Give yourself grace, support others, let the data tell the story. We're signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.